Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Much has been written and said about the Jewish Holocaust, perhaps the most tragic event of the 20th century. Yet there's still so much we don't understand. How could such a thing have ever happened? And what was it like to experience such systematic and devastating acts of hostility? In a few moments, we'll take one step closer to answering the second question when we talk to historian Marian Kaplan about her new book, Between Dignity and Despair, Jewish Life in Nazi Germany. But first, let's look back at this week in history. The date was November 19th, 1863. The event, a speech that lasted only 2 minutes. The occasion, the dedication of a national cemetery at the site of the Battle of Gettysburg. The principal speaker, Harvard's Edward Everett, completed his two-hour oration, and President Abraham Lincoln was called upon to provide some concluding remarks. Those brief remarks, now known as the Gettysburg Address, took the nation by storm, and when he assured the American people that those who had died at Gettysburg had not died in vain, but rather to ensure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from the earth. Turning to this week's history in the news, the recently released diary of President Kennedy's private secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, is adding a new, more personal dimension to our understanding of America's slain leader. It recounts everything from conversations between Kennedy and other famous leaders to private moments in the president's residence where, Ms. Lincoln notes, he practices speeches while bathing. Japanese Prime Minister Keizo Obuchi has offered his nation's apologies for Japan's colonial occupation of Korea from 1910 to 1945. Included in a joint declaration by the two countries, the Prime Minister stated that the Japanese humbly accepted the historical fact that Japanese colonial rule inflicted unbearable damage and pain on the Korean people and expressed remorseful repentance and heartfelt apologies for the ordeal. And relating to our interview today on the Holocaust, a cross-planting campaign at the former Nazi death camp, Auschwitz, is straining relations between Jews and Catholics. In a field next to the death camp, Catholics have collected a sea of crosses to honor those Christians who lost their lives at the site. Jews, who accounted for more than 90% of the 1.5 million victims at Auschwitz, viewed the display as a disrespectful intrusion on what is the largest Jewish cemetery in the world. You are listening to Talking History. The Jewish Holocaust was Adolf Hitler's final solution to the so-called Jewish problem in Europe. It resulted in the deaths of 6 million Jews and broken lives for many more. But what was it like to be a Jew and a woman living through such a horrendous period? That's the subject of our interview for this week, in which Talking History's Eileen Dugan talks to historian Marian Kaplan.
It is easy to look at the past with 20/20 hindsight. Case in point, the plight of the Jews in Germany in the 1930s. When they learn of the increased anti-Semitism of this period, the official laws methodically stripping Jews of their rights, and the personal day-to-day hostility which they endured, most people today ask, didn't the Jews see the writing on the wall? Why didn't they leave then, before the Holocaust could even begin? Historians, however, must free themselves from the habit of hindsight and must attempt to see the world through the eyes of those who lived at the time. Dr. Marian Kaplan, professor of history at Queens College of the City University of New York, has accomplished this difficult feat in her recent book, Between Dignity and Despair, Jewish Life in Nazi Germany. Professor Kaplan, whose own parents fled Nazi Germany, pays particular attention to the actions of Jewish women in the 1930s, providing a new perspective upon the anguishing social death of the Jews, which she demonstrates was an absolute prerequisite for the final solution. Welcome, Professor Kaplan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, let's begin with this question of what was the status of the Jews in Germany before 1933?
Well, first we have to start off with the fact that Jews were a tiny, tiny minority. About 500,000 Jews, about 1%, under 1% of the population. And like every minority, they had a career profile that differed significantly from that of the general population. They had been historically prohibited from participating in a variety of economic endeavors and wound up mostly in business and commerce, so that about over 60% of Jews worked in business and commerce. They mostly lived in the cities. They were an urban population. About 80% lived in the cities. A third of Jews lived in Berlin. Many of them were also involved in the professions, so that if you look at lawyers, for example, even though Jews were only 1% of the German population, they were about 16% of the legal and 10% of the medical professions. So they had a very stark career profile that was different from others. In fact, if you were going to compare them to any group, you would compare them possibly to American Jews today.
Now, how did all of this begin to change, both publicly and privately, with the rise of Hitler?
Well, to begin with, the Nazis came to power in January 1933, and yet immediately it began to change. In April of that year, for example, the Nazis passed what was known as what we call the April Laws, which were laws that excluded Jews from the medical profession, the legal profession, the civil service, in which they were not highly represented anyway, since the civil service was pretty anti-Semitic at the time. But it excluded them from major fields of endeavor. It set quotas on schools for Jewish children, on universities and schools of higher learning. In that year, in that same first year, the Chamber of Culture excluded Jews from film, theater, music, fine arts, literature, journalism, areas in which Jews had been disproportionately active. So within the first year, there were legal exclusions and important economic boycotts. The Nazis declared a boycott of all Jewish businesses and professionals on April 1st of 1933. And although that wasn't a major Nazi success, it was the beginning of sporadic and continuous boycotts against Jewish businesses, so that many smaller businesses, the mom-and-pop shops, were forced to close down in very few years.
What about on a personal level? How did things begin to change for Jews on a personal level?
On a personal level, there were three elements that I point to. The reactions of strangers, the reactions of neighbors, and that of friends. Strangers began to point out who looked like a Jew on a bus or on a tram. In fact, they often got it wrong because Jews looked very much like other people, like other Germans. But there was a stereotype that the German, the Aryan, what they call themselves, was a blonde-haired, tall, blue-eyed person, and that Jews were dark and short. And of course, nobody ever fits into every stereotype. If you look at Hitler, he was dark and short. And so there would be strangers pointing out, you know, this person looks Jewish or that poor person looks Jewish, and of course sometimes getting it right and frightening Jews from appearing in public very often. Neighbors who had been collegial, friendly, sociable for years, sometimes for generations, stopped talking to Jews. And friends gradually began to turn away, so that by 1935, just within 2 years, non-Jewish friends became a rarity.
How do Jews perceive these changes, especially the Jewish women? How do they react to these changes?
Well, it's interesting because what I find here is a gender difference. Jewish women react very strongly to personal slights when the postman looks through them, when the neighbor doesn't say good morning, when a child loses a non-Jewish friend because they call him a dirty Jew or something like that. Whereas the men tend to look much more closely and tend to react much more to public pronouncements, political pronouncements, radio announcements, to the legal dimension of German anti-Semitism. So that if my image in my mind is a wife coming to her husband and saying, Johnny got beaten up on the way home from school today, and the husband saying, yes, but the Nazis have decreed that, you know, now Jews can live in Germany with these disabilities and they won't touch us anymore. So they were always looking at different things. Their antenna were tuned to different kinds of different clues.
Well, at this point, of course, there comes that inevitable question. The laws were being promulgated, strangers were turning against them, even friends that they'd known for years had began turning against the Jews. If things were getting so much worse for them, person with 20/20 hindsight now says, why didn't they start to leave Germany in great numbers?
Well, there are a couple of important reasons. The first is that in the 1930s, there was a worldwide depression, and the nations that were, you know, possible nations of refuge didn't want new immigrants, and so it was very, very hard to get into another country. That's the first, probably the most important reason, way more important than Jewish perceptions, because once Jews did perceive the danger, which was in November 1938, they still couldn't get in. They couldn't have gotten in 35 any easier than they could have gotten in 38. So that's the first part, that nations of refuge closed their doors. But there are other important reasons, too. How many Americans today, perceiving discrimination against them, would necessarily pick up, lock, stock, and barrel, move to a strange country with a new language, and take that risk? How many people would do that? How many fathers, how many breadwinners today, of course, women and men are breadwinners, but in those days, mostly the fathers, the husbands, how many breadwinners would risk that? They would prefer to risk staying and putting up with more disabilities than forging a brand new path in the midst of a depression. Some of these professionals were business people, and to get out of Germany and to start a new business, they would have needed something called money, but the Germans blocked all Jewish bank accounts and took all Jewish property, so that it was very hard to come to a new nation penniless with a family. So I think those are important reasons why they stayed. There's also confusion in the 1930s. There's one story I tell about a young woman whose father in 1935 is asked to come down to City Hall to get an award for having been a World War I veteran, and he's given this award, this Jewish man is given an award with a swastika on it. So there are all these mixed signals going on. Then in 1936 you have the Great Olympics in Berlin, and right before the Olympics the Nazis go much more easily on Jewish, on anti-Semitic laws and decrees, because they want to put a good face out to the rest of the world. So in the 1936 period, although there are still the economic boycotts, there's less vitriolic anti-Semitic decrees, attacks, etc. There are fewer of those against Jews. And so again, people look at these mixed messages and they prefer the message that says we can live here even though we are going to be increasingly disabled. I should add that Jews had just become emancipated in Germany by the 1870s, right? 1866, 1870, they became equal citizens. So some Jews saw the Nazis as a step backwards, but not as a brand new step into the unknown.
Now, what did Jewish women do in the mid-1930s to try to survive in this increasingly hostile environment?
They took a very, very active role, because Jewish men tended to be physically abused, often arrested, tortured, beaten up by the Nazis. So Jewish women took a much more active public role than they had ever before in their histories. They represented their men to the authorities. They represented their husbands to the Gestapo, which was the secret police, to the finance offices, to the emigration offices. They did a lot of the public mediation between their families and the government. They took jobs when their husband's business began to fail or when their husbands were fired. These were mostly middle-class women, a very small proportion of whom ever really worked outside the home, and suddenly they began to work outside the home. They began retraining for jobs in countries of emigration. As the 1930s continued onwards, there was emigration, so that you have 20,000, 30,000 people emigrating per year, and Jewish women looked for jobs that would be useful in lands of emigration, mostly as domestic household help, as seamstresses, as tailors, as people who could, you know, basically stitch together a livelihood in the new country. They also interceded for their children at school, and they continually pressed their husbands and brothers and fathers to emigrate. Jewish women clearly wanted to emigrate well before Jewish men were willing to consider that. And I think that has to do with men being breadwinners, as I said before.
What was life like for children during this period?
Well, it depended. If a child went to a Jewish school or to a non-Jewish school, if it went to a public school with many non-Jews, there was almost immediate discrimination by teachers, And often, very often, by other children, so that many of the Jewish children felt friendless and abandoned. This depended, though, again, on whether they lived in small towns and villages or in big cities. In Berlin, the stories are less horrible. There are more children who were able to find friends or maintain friends for a longer period of time. In the small towns, they were terribly ostracized, especially in the playgrounds, during the recesses where nobody would talk with them. If they went to Jewish schools, they lived in a kind of fake oasis where they learned new languages for emigration, English, French, and Hebrew, where they learned sometimes for the first time about Jewish history and Jewish culture, because Jews were highly acculturated into German society, and many of them had lost some contact with, you know, with Hebrew, with Jewish religion and Jewish tradition. So sometimes the Jewish schools brought this back for Jews in a kind of sense of elan, in a sense that they were, that they should learn a little bit about their history so that they could be proud of their history rather than feel bad about themselves, which is what the Nazis, of course, wanted them to feel.
Now, how on a personal level did Jews react to the November pogrom of 1938 or the deportations, the rumors of genocide?
Well, I'd have to break that down. The November pogrom was clearly the signal to get out. After the pogrom, almost everyone tried to get out. And those who didn't get out were stuck there because, as I really emphasize over and over again, most countries didn't let them in. They were old, they were poor, they didn't think they could start a new life. About 80% of young people under the age of 25 did get out. When I say get out, about two-thirds of German Jews actually left Germany, not all to safety, because some of them went to European countries where they were later caught. If they emigrated to France or to Holland or to Belgium, they were deported later on to the camps in the east. But about 50% actually managed to get out to safety. So I think that emigration really picks up after the November pogrom and continues to pick up, but the Nazis ultimately shut all doors in 1941, in October 1941, and forbid emigration, because by that time they've turned their thoughts toward annihilation. So that's the November pogrom. In terms of the deportations and the rumors of genocide, at the beginning of my book, I quote from Leo Tolstoy, who says, and I want to quote it here too, "At the advent of danger, there are always two voices that speak in the human heart. One invites consideration of the nature of the peril and the means of escaping it. The other argues that it is not in man's power to foresee everything." And I think that's exactly the split among German Jews. There were those who said, we have to flee, we're in danger. It was not clear that they were going to be annihilated, but by 1942 there were strong rumors to that effect as well. We have to go into hiding. And there were those who, hearing some of the same rumors, thought that it couldn't be that bad, that they were going to be deported to work camps, to labor camps, and that was the worst of it. So they either didn't know or denied what they heard.
Yeah, we have only a minute remaining, but perhaps you could quickly tell us why it is important to understand the experiences of Jewish women in particular in the Nazi period.
I think that what's really important here is that there are very important gender differences in the way people react to persecution and in the way they are persecuted. The Nazis persecuted Jewish men more harshly at first, leaving the mistaken belief that women weren't going to be touched. I think that they react very differently. Women wanted to flee earlier, and in fact, in the end, more women remained. So I think there are all kinds of reasons why we should look at men and women in danger and not assume that they will react simply as a human being, but they react as they are socialized as men and women.
All right, well, we're out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you, Professor Kaplan.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Professor Marian Kaplan, Professor of History at Queens College of the City University of New York, about her monograph, Between Dignity and Despair, Jewish Life in Nazi Germany.
Well,
welcome back. And following up on Marion Kaplan's remarks, our site of the week for this program also relates to the Jewish Holocaust. And here to describe it for us is Talking History's Cindy Werthmann.
The Yad Vashem, located on the Mount of Remembrance in Jerusalem, was established in 1953 by an act of the Israeli Knesset. The 45-acre complex of museums, monuments, and research centers is not only one of the oldest, but is also one of the most impressive and instructive memorials to the Jewish people who died in the Holocaust. To learn more about this site, visit Yad Vashem's homepage at www.yad-vashem.org. If you can't make it to Jerusalem, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. has plenty to offer visitors on the Holocaust. More than 10 million people have visited the museum since it opened 5 years ago.
Thank you, Cindy. Earlier in our show, Marion Kaplan talked about women in the Jewish Holocaust. But what about women in the other Holocausts of history? Was their experience the same? Here to comment on women in the Cambodian Holocaust of the mid-1970s is Elizabeth Che. Che is a Cambodian-American writer who lives in Norwalk, California. A reporter for the Orange County Register, she's been collecting stories and writing about the Cambodian genocide for several years.
Our family often sat on our living room floor and shared stories. They were my version of campfire ghost stories, filled with mysticism and intrigue. Tales of trapped souls, haunting straw-roofed huts, ditches full of decaying bodies, floating soldiers, and a blood-soaked Mekong River. They were stories of the Cambodian genocide. In my mind, they hung on the edge of reality and folklore, but they were all real. My aunts used to tell me how as girls they were more like boys, trapping field mice and river eels with makeshift bamboo traps. Girls as old as 18 did not menstruate because their bodies lacked nutrition. Both men and women worked long hours with only watery spoonfuls of rice porridge to hold their empty stomachs. Mothers told me stories of how they would force themselves to vomit because their breasts would no longer give milk. They cradled hungry babies, buried many. Cambodian women saw their husbands dragged off and beaten in the fields. Some women saw their fathers and sons bound and shot before they could shield the bullets with their own bodies. But much of that is hidden behind a soft, meditative smile. It is unspoken, unwritten, and accepted fate. Today, in America, Cambodian women are not touted as heroines. Instead, many are regarded as welfare moms, too lazy to find work or learn English, too busy breeding gangsters. A mother came to me in tears after her son had died in a drive-by shooting in Long Beach, California. Her words were simple. I struggled so hard to keep my family alive, dodging death in Cambodia, to have a son die of a bullet in America. These women share a common bond with Jews, Armenians, Rwandans, Native Americans. They are all victims of humanity's ugliest crime, Holocaust. Their stories seldom spread beyond living rooms and family histories, but their lessons need to be shared by the world.
You've been listening to Elizabeth Che, a reporter for the Orange County Register. This is Talking History. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, films, television shows, museum exhibits, and other events that may be of interest to our listeners. On November 18th, PBS will take a 100-year leap back in time with the premiere of the 11th season of The American Experience. This season will begin with a three-hour special titled America 1900, which will look at the nation at the dawn of the 20th century. Narrated by David McCullough, the show will explore the political events of the year, the flood of new technology that ushered in the century, and such pop culture topics as the rise of the five-and-dime store and ragtime music. Check your local listings for showtimes. And next month, watch for a new film at your local theater titled Shakespeare in Love. The film, based on the life of one of the world's most famous writers, stars Ben Affleck and Gwyneth Paltrow. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us again next week for our special Thanksgiving show, complete with historic recipes. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.